Dave Consolazio alongside Sam Saig for episode 9 of Running the Option. Sam, how you doing?
I'm doing good. I'm a little confused, though. I mean, I want to say the national championship is on Monday, January the 9th at the Superdome in New Orleans, but based on the buzz this week, maybe it's actually in Tuscaloosa at Bryant-Denny Stadium Saturday night. Can you help me?
Hard to argue against that. We'll get to that in an entire show worth of a segment. We generally do about 4 segments on the show here. First, I want to talk a little bit about last week because it was such a great week of college football. And then segment 2/... Episode 9 of Running the Option, we're just going to do Alabama-LSU. We will beat it to death as much as we possibly can, because there's not enough media on this game, is there? I can't seem to find any. I go online, I go on the TV, I can't find any media on this game, so we need to beat it to death, too.
We've got you covered. I know you haven't heard it, but we'll get the whole matchup covered.
We will run the option, don't you worry about a thing. If you have a college football podcast, I think you have to talk about that game. You'll have to forgive us if you've heard enough about that game. But let's talk about last week first. So much happened. Okay, let's start with Case Keenum, Thursday night, 73-34 over Rice, 534 passing yards, 9 passing touchdowns, becomes the all-time passing touchdown leader with 139. Graham Harrell had 135. Crazy thing about Case Keenum, he's not even close to done yet. Obviously, they have 4 more regular season games, Houston does. Then they have the Conference USA Championship game. And then, of course, they probably have a bowl game as well. Or they do have a bowl game coming up. So that's 6 more games for Case Keenum. Figure about 4 touchdowns a game, he could tack on another 20-plus. Incredible how much he'll beat this record by 10.
Yeah, and a great story after the injury, because for him to be in this situation that we all knew was very likely to happen, but for it to happen and for him to do it in that kind of a monster game with 73 points, it's just a great story. And even though it's Conference USA, and we talk about how fun that conference is, but it's just great to see that this career is going to be capped off with this much of a legacy left behind.
Without question, one of the great college quarterbacks of all time, and the greatest coach of all time, hard to argue against, Joe Paterno gets win number 409, passes Eddie Robinson for the most wins in Division I history. Huge accomplishment for a Penn State team, the ugliest 8-1 team I've ever seen, but this is Penn State football. This is Joe Pa football.
It is, and again, when it comes to this year's Penn State team, at the end of the day, because of the way that they're winning, and if they do go on to somehow win that division, which seemed completely unlikely a few weeks ago, but they're in a position to do it, and who cares what the scores are? We've been pretty outspoken about not believing in this team, but they're 2 games in the lead right now in that division. So if they keep doing this, now their tests are still ahead, but can you imagine Joe Pa already having this record, well-deserved, but can you imagine him capping it off in a Big Ten championship setting? That would be even more remarkable.
Yeah, whether they won that one or not, they'd certainly be the underdog, but to see them in the Big Ten championship would be a fitting way to have your first Big Ten championship with the greatest coach of all time on the sideline. And then you have Oklahoma. We said Oklahoma would take care of business in that Kansas State game, but I don't think we quite saw the Kansas State Cinderella season coming to an end with a 58-17 loss.
I mean, we did pretty much nail that it was going to be an easy Oklahoma win even on the road. But no, I didn't expect a near 60-point outburst. What we can say is Big Game Bob, this is what he does, right? he comes off of a disappointing loss, easily rallies his troops for a road game against a jacked up and undefeated Kansas State squad, disposes of them easily, as he's done with teams in the past coming off
of
the
loss. You called it last week, because I said, what if Oklahoma comes out depressed about what had happened the week before? You said, no, look at his history, it never happened.
I mean, I wish I could be a fly on the wall of what their practices are like, because they always seem to play their best after one of those really mysterious losses. They had 690 yards against a pretty proud K-State defense, and that's just as irritating to me as it is impressive, given the fact that they got beat by an inferior opponent the week before at home. They end their 39-game winning streak at home. It's one of those things where this is what this team is capable of being against anyone, including one of those SEC teams, as far as being able to compete on any day with any team. team. And so here's what I will say, though. If you look at it, and this is kind of nuts to think about, but this is what happened in 2008. They had a similar, they had a loss to Texas. Then they started like blowing people out in record-setting fashion, and they got themselves right back in the national title picture and then into that game eventually. If you look at it, they're sixth in the BCS. If Stanford loses to Oregon and they take care of Oklahoma State, they could jump Boise and be right back in the picture.
It's a great point, and it's crazy to me that at the end of the first half, they kick a long field goal to take a six-point lead in the game, and they're jumping around, and they're genuinely happy and excited, and there just doesn't seem to be any carryover from the week before. No. There just didn't seem to be this, because when you saw Oregon lose to LSU, the week afterwards, they had the big win over a weak team, but after touchdowns, they just kind of seemed a little down, because they had, like you said in a past podcast, built that game up to be their whole season. Oklahoma, you don't see that. They just look like they're just loving life going out there and beating these teams. I don't get it, but like you said, maybe that fly in the wall, maybe you would have heard Stoop say, hey, we're still in this. As bad as that loss is, we're still in this. Look at what has been going on all over the place in college football. We could probably jump an undefeated Boise State. I mean, the pollsters don't love them, so who knows? And then we nailed that Nebraska game. I mean, you can't take anything away from Michigan State coming off of the two big wins that they had. But that said, I would have never in a million years thought Nebraska, with the way their defense has been playing this year, could hold anybody to three, let alone a Michigan State team that was rolling the way they were.
Yeah, I mean, that game, we thought there would be a letdown factor. It looked like a letdown game. It turned out to be, obviously, a huge letdown game. And Nebraska was all over it, because they were pitching it that way throughout the week. I mean, Bo Pelini hinted at it, hoped that Michigan State would come in with nothing left in terms of all their excitement was blown the previous 2 weeks. And they were just so ready and sitting almost on that game, and it went exactly how Nebraska fans would have dreamed it up.
And when you look at the opposite side of that big Michigan State upset, the Wisconsin Badgers, who go from arguably our favorite team of the bunch right behind LSU, Alabama, to an afterthought all of a sudden with another crazy loss last week.
This was a disappointment. I don't know how else to say it, because a lot's going to be made about how the Badgers lost the last 2 weeks on essentially Hail Mary plays with seconds left, and they're two plays away potentially from being number four in the BCS, let's say. The thing is, I look at this game, and I'm not sure I'm going to pin this one on one pass the way that we would the game against Michigan State, because if you look at it, the problem is Wisconsin's defense could not get a hold of Braxton Miller. They couldn't tackle him. He didn't have a particularly great day passing, 7 of 12, 89 yards and a touchdown. 40 of those yards and the touchdown came with 20 seconds left on that ridiculous bomb, that pass to win it. But the thing is, Wisconsin really didn't have an answer for stopping the run. This is a program that prides itself on running the ball and stopping the run. They couldn't stop the run. Braxton Miller ran for 99 yards and two touchdowns. Dan Heron ran for 160 yards. I'm going to look at that, and I'm going to look at something else. And that is, how in the world can Wisconsin, after giving up a game-changing blocked punt for a touchdown, not address special teams? They give up another blocked punt that leads to a score in this game. Their kickoff coverage was awful. I'm not going to look at that last play, even though Braxton Miller is the hero for Ohio State. And by the way, Ohio State's slowly becoming a pretty good story.
And Braxton Miller is becoming a star in the making. Yeah.
But what in the world is Wisconsin doing to let another special teams error, you know, blow that game a little bit for them?
And maybe that's where you do have to give a guy like Bob Stoops credit, because, you know, we talked last week about him not bringing this team to the next level, but it does say a lot about a coach that can get his players motivated for weeks after big losses, because this looked like a Wisconsin team to me that wasn't prepared for this Ohio State game, and they absolutely should have been. I mean, this Ohio State team with Braxton Miller at quarterback isn't a threat to pass the ball. They're just not, and if you go in with the mindset that we're going to stop the run, which, like you said, they should be capable of doing, it's what they're built to do, you should win this game, bounce back, and you should be right there in that conversation of teams that, hey, with all the things shaking out right, maybe they get back into the conversation. They're not going to now, and they're going to be a complete afterthought. All of a sudden, you know, at the end of the year when we're talking about top 10 teams, we're not even going to be talking about them anymore, which is crazy considering how dominant they were through the first half of the season.
Right, they're a full two games back of Penn State now in the leaders division. Now a lot is still to go, including those teams playing each other, but it's crazy that we can sit here and now discount and write off Wisconsin as far as the storylines that are major storylines in college football. Who would have thought they'd be an afterthought at this point?
Yeah, I wanted to see that Stanford-Wisconsin game play out in the Rose Bowl, assuming that one of those teams wasn't in the national championship, and now all of a sudden I don't even want to see that game. That would be a letdown for me to see Stanford going up against a Wisconsin team that's clearly beatable. How did that happen in 2 weeks? That's college football in a nutshell. Mm-hmm. Georgia tops Florida in the world's largest outdoor cocktail party. I just brought that game up strictly to say that again here on the podcast, but great come-from-behind victory for Georgia, and really continues to keep the race close between them and South Carolina.
That was the game that even when they were loaded in the past, when they had all the talent in the world, they couldn't get over the hump in a game against Florida. Now, Florida's obviously a lot more down, but winning that game psychologically does so much for the Georgia team, the coaching staff, and the fan base, that might actually be the start of the downhill kind of part of their schedule where they can start to really hone in on getting that SEC East one. I mean, you wouldn't have thought after especially the way against South Carolina it didn't go their way, but to be in this position now where, yes, South Carolina has one loss and you still have to worry about them, but Georgia is in attack mode now after that game against Florida, feeling pretty good.
And while South Carolina's schedule is somewhat manageable, they have the tough one against Arkansas this week, and Georgia controls their own destiny if South Carolina loses one game, so could definitely happen. They could still top the East. Georgia Tech, I said that would be a tough game for Clemson. I didn't realize it would be that great of a game for Georgia Tech. You know, I had a feeling their offense would come around. It did. I said their defense might play well. It did. Had no idea that anybody could hold this year's Clemson team to 17.
You nailed it.
I occasionally get one right. Yeah. You know, you shoot enough fish in a barrel, you're bound to hit one, as I've said before. But you know, the thing about that game, because I was watching three games at once, and I had that one, fortunately, on ESPN3, so I had that up on the computer screen, and I'm watching that game. You know, the crazy thing about that game is it should have been worse for Clemson. Georgia Tech was knocking on the door. They were about to punch it in to go up 28. When Clemson jumps off sides to force a fumble, the offsides isn't called, the fumble stands. Clemson goes 95 yards for a touchdown, and then, wildly enough, Georgia Tech only up 14 and needing to just protect the lead, throws a careless interception. Clemson has the ball first and goal from the 9, and Taj Boyd turns around and throws an interception, and we were just talking last week about how he hasn't done that and how Clemson hasn't been Clemson. And on that play, Clemson was Clemson. People look at the final score and they see 31-17 Georgia Tech. They saw how the first half went. I think they just say, okay, Georgia Tech beat them. But if you were watching that game, if they make the play there, it's a 7-point game with about 9 minutes left. Clemson probably goes on to win that game. Yeah. So, and then that fumble play would have really come under scrutiny. But Georgia Tech gets away, and they deserved it. They played better on both sides of the ball.
Yeah, it was a wild sequence, that series of plays. And for me, this is the thing about Georgia Tech. I've obviously had a lot of words for them throughout the season. both high and low.
Yeah.
And low lately, obviously, given the last few weeks. But they really did get back to playing their brand of football this week with a brilliant performance on the ground. One of the most overanalyzed statistics, and now recently a lot of analysts are saying they're dismissing it as one of the most useless statistics in football,
uh-huh,
is time of possession. That's actually been thrown out a lot lately by people that are analysts.
That's a great point, because that's always been the standard,
yeah,
for which team dominated the game,
sure,
so to speak. If you have the time of possession battle won, that's supposed to mean you dominated.
Yeah, and the reason that statistic has been kind of diminished, mm-hmm, in its importance is because recently, with the quick strike nature of spread offenses, especially offenses like Oklahoma State and Oregon. Oregon's a great example.
Auburn last year,
these teams, and I think about Oregon a lot because they say this, is that they don't care about time of possession. They score 20 seconds at a time. They usually lose the time of possession and still win in blowout fashion. But in a game like this one, it shows how important time of possession can be, because Georgia Tech had a plan for how to attack Clemson, knowing that they were vulnerable in the run game, in the run defense. And they controlled the ball for nearly 40 minutes and absolutely tortured and frustrated a very impatient and antsy Clemson team, because Clemson on offense was sitting on that sideline just kind of waiting in a really nervous fashion. When are we going to get the ball? When are we going to get the ball? We're down by a few points. We need to score in a hurry. And that affected their rhythm on offense. That triple option is so diverse because it forces a defense to account for three different possibilities. Obviously, the fullback up the gut, the quarterback keeper, and then the pitch to the wide boundary. And Clemson was only prepared for two of those at a time. So they were really not equipped either personnel-wise or scheme-wise.
And this is what you loved about this offense so much when we were talking about how it was unstoppable. Right. So I don't understand what happened over the 3 weeks before this game where teams figured out those three attacks.
Well, and you pointed out that this series has not treated Clemson well. And clearly, this is just not, you know, Clemson, this is their kryptonite in the ACC. They cannot get over this game. Georgia Tech ran for 383 yards and controlled the clock all throughout it, which is exactly what Paul Johnson wanted.
That's what we saw in the, sorry to cut you off, but that's what we saw in the Syracuse-West Virginia game in that, you know, how do you stop a Dana Holgorsen offense? You keep them off the field, and sometimes that time of possession really is valuable.
And it was a perfect recipe for disaster because Clemson also turned the ball over. They had new running backs in for Andre Ellington who didn't play. They fumbled the ball, each of them, and Taj Boyd, like we said, he just wasn't his turnover-less self. He was turnover-prone this week, and that was a killer.
Speaking of turnover-prone, great timing on your part. Last week, you brought up Oklahoma State's defense, how they're a bend. They're not a bend, don't break defense. They're a bend some more. Go Gumby, stretch Armstrong, bend, and then don't break. Right. And they force these turnovers. What in the bottom 10 teams in the league in total yards against, and then in the top in turnovers forced. Well, true to form last week, they give up 622 yards to Baylor, yet they forced 5 turnovers. They were up 42-0 in that game, and, you know, I had to say to myself, at some point, I have to start saying this Oklahoma State defense isn't a liability. Yeah. This is the way that they play, and they play it well. At some point, we have to stop saying this is a weakness for them, because it doesn't make sense statistically to me, but it's passing the eye test. We've gotten so far in the season now that I can't continue to say that this is a fluke, or can we?
Well, and like time of possession, in this case, it's a defensive stat that we can throw out for this team, and that's the yards, the total yards they give up, because like you said, who cares if you're giving up 622 yards? That's perfectly within their comfort zone now of how they've won games. If you put up nearly 60 points and get the ball turned over to your offense that many times, then you're in your comfort zone, and that's just how they play, you know, on a weekly basis. Will it catch up to them eventually against a team that doesn't turn it over? Like, imagine them playing a team like Alabama, who takes all of that away and really puts their will and their style into a game. I don't know, maybe it would eventually catch up to them then, but for now, that's what they like to do.
It's working, and it could get them that shot against Alabama or LSU, because they look like they can manage their schedule with the way they're playing. Lastly, the biggest game of the week, the incredible triple overtime Stanford-USC game. What were your thoughts? What did you take away from that game?
Well, my first initial thoughts on the game after the game, like not even talking about how great of a game it was and how amazing it was for college football in the Pac-12, but with the 56 points, Andrew Luck has now put up the most points on USC in their history twice in his career. He did it in 09 with 55 at the Coliseum and 56 in this game at the Coliseum. Now, obviously, it took 3 overtimes, but that, in the many amazing stats of Andrew Luck, to me, that's just as significant, because this is USC, one of the top 3 to 5 storied programs in college football history, with all of that amazing history in the Coliseum, and he does it twice to them in his career.
I don't know, you know, how the Heisman voting formula works, and it's not really a formula, it's just a bunch of guys with votes, they can vote how they want to, but finally, he's on the national stage. It's not one of those West Coast, nobody saw it games. Everybody was watching this game. And he's got the ball in a tie game late. And I'm thinking, finally, here's his Heisman moment. You know, he takes the lead and wins the game for Stanford. He throws the pick six. But I came away more impressed with the drive right after the pick six, because I heard from a lot of people, reporters and fans alike, that the Coliseum was the loudest it's been since USC's championship day, since their heyday. That stadium was going nuts, and credit to the fans who really bought into this team as essentially their bowl game. I mean, it was everything you could have hoped for a USC fan, other than the win, of course. But that pick six, the place was going insane. And if you had any doubts in your mind about Andrew Luck as the first overall pick, which not many did, but if you did, the complete composure on this kid's face. He's not a kid, he's a man. And it never fazed him. He just throws that ball, and I can name half of the quarterbacks in the NFL starters right now that in that same situation would have folded under the pressure. He just, like a complete professional, just said, sorry about that, guys. We're going to go tie it up. We're going to win it in overtime. And they did. Incredible.
Like any great player, he wanted the ball in his hands after the pick six. He wasn't gun shy about it. Great players want the ball. They want those moments in that stadium with that crowd. The crowd probably even fueled him because he's that kind of player. I've never seen a pick six work so much in the favor of a Heisman Trophy candidate, but I think Kirk Herbstreit said the same thing. That pick six happening actually demonstrated his greatness even more because of how he followed it.
It defined him. It really did.
And Stanford ran its winning streak to 16, but it was just about as difficult as you can make it because USC played one heck of a game, and it was great for the Pac-12 to have that type of game. I mean, I thought Matt Barkley matched Andrew Luck for a long time there because they had pretty much the same statistics. I mean, Barkley had 3 touchdowns and a pick. Luck had 3 touchdowns and a pick. And like Wisconsin, we wanted to see how Stanford would do in a game where there was adversity. They were in too many blowouts. I mean, they held their last 13 opponents to 21 points or fewer. What was it going to be like when they finally got tested? And they were in this game, and they came out on top. So, you have to really credit them for that.
A huge win for them, a huge win for Andrew Luck, and a huge win for David Shaw, because he needed to be tested too, and credit him for the play calls down the stretch. I was a little confused on that 3rd and 9 when he takes the ball out of Andrew Luck's hands. But, for all these creative geniuses, there's always a play or two every game that leaves you scratching your head, but it's easy from your couch at home to criticize these guys. But last thing before we move on to the big game about this game, there was a lot of controversy. Lane Kiffin had a lot of things to say about the officiating in this game. And, of course, some fans are talking about how the Pac-12 wanted Stanford in there, so the game was fixed. What are your thoughts on all that nonsense?
I mean, I certainly wouldn't touch the fixed part of it, but the two plays, I mean, you look at the TJ McDonald play, and TJ McDonald, number 7 safety for USC, who kind of channels some of the Taylor Mays qualities that you've seen in the past out of that position. But he, I do believe, has gotten maybe an unfair label as being a dirty player over the course of this season by Pac-12 refs. And it might have come back to bite him in this game because there's no doubt that hit had excessive force. But when you really slow it down, and I think this is what Lane Kiffin wanted to say. He said, if I took TJ into the Pac-12 offices and sat down with all the refs and with Larry Scott and played that play, I would want them to tell me what could he have done different or what should he have done different. Because if you look at it and slow it down, and again, they happen so fast that you can't fault the refs either. But he led with his shoulder, if you look at it, and they said he might have launched himself, but his right foot and his feet were still on the ground. At the end of the day, it was such a hard hit. It was such a vicious hit that I think that's what drew the flag, just the force of it, especially since the receiver had dropped it. But it's such a split-second thing that you can see from Lane Kiffin and TJ McDonald's side, what was I supposed to do? I thought the guy caught the ball in that moment. I had to jar it out of there. You're taught to lead with your shoulder and have a huge hit, and that's what he did. It's a tough situation all the way around, but I think that might have been, Pac-12 refs have been accused of kind of leading with reputation calls on some certain guys. This might have been one of those.
I could see that criticism, and both McDonald and Kiffin obviously have every reason to be upset. But at the same time, I've seen that called that way just about every time. I can't criticize the refs for making the call that they always seem to make. One of the reasons it might be a reputation call is because a lot of guys aren't capable of making that big of a hit. You know what I mean? Yeah. Maybe a guy that hits a little softer, it doesn't look as bad. But the point being, when I saw it live, I thought it was a penalty. I'm sure the ref saw the same thing. And you're right. If you go in, you put that tape in, and you look at it structurally, you're probably going to have a tough time saying exactly what was wrong with it. But it was high, and it was hard. And whether you like it or not, in football today, that penalty is called. I mean, I don't think that was unfair treatment. That's what football is today, and it's for better or worse.
It's like umpires. Umpires have strike zones. They stick to them. And even if a call might be left or right of the zone, if the zone is the same every time, you have to learn to deal with that. These calls have been pretty similar across college football. If you go in that hard and up high, you just have to expect it.
And what did you think of the controversy at the end of the game with a second left? They were looking if he was out of bounds, yeah. And he was in bounds, and there was 1 second left, then there was the timeout call. What did you make of all that?
Well, again, you know, and Lane Kiffin obviously brought this up. So the protocol, obviously the referee gets to make the final judgment. The sideline judge in that game, evidently, according to Lane Kiffin, Robert Woods didn't get out of bounds. The play took longer than SC expected. It was meant to run 7 seconds, and it ran 9, obviously, or at least 8. And that wasn't supposed to happen. Robert Woods took the play outside. But the knee was down, if you look at the replay. And Lane Kiffin's point was, we know he didn't get out of bounds. That's not our argument. We think he was in bounds, and I immediately called timeout. And the sideline judge awarded me that timeout and said he'd go and talk about it. At the end of the day, when they met up the refs, they came back and the call went against USC. I think Lane Kiffin's concern was, why did you go into that meeting saying, I'm going to get that timeout for you, and you came out of it without the timeout? You know, so I think that's where he was coming from.
I mean, and I get this argument too, and it makes sense, and I believe he even said that he, before the play even started, said to that line judge, when the second the play ends, timeout, I got my timeout. And that's what he was arguing after the fact, you know, that they were making fun of him in the broadcast saying, you're not going to win this one, Lane, but he was saying, you know, I said as soon as the play is over, it's a timeout. The line judge agreed with me, so why isn't it a timeout? The problem is, and you can blame Robert Woods for this, it's not necessarily all Lane Kiffin's fault, but if that was the idea, that it wasn't essential to get out of bounds, they had a timeout, he just has to fall down and with 4 seconds left, call a timeout, or 3 seconds, or 2 seconds, or whatever. If it was always designed to end in a timeout, don't leave it to chance like that, because it was a half second either way, and I don't know that you're, I mean, maybe you are, maybe you aren't, I guess it depends on the line judge or the head referee, but I don't know that you're allowed to call a timeout before the play actually ends. And so there's like a half second there where if you actually knee down and then he runs and calls timeout, he probably didn't get it in on time, so you leave it too much to chance.
And
I
think
opinion.
Lane Kiffin even admitted the play certainly took longer than it was designed to take. I mean, I don't know if Robert Woods freaked out and knew that, and so he wanted to get out of bounds, but it certainly wasn't designed to be that long. And in the end, they cut it way too close.
But regardless of where you land on the controversies, incredible game,
sure.
Big win for Stanford, and very, very strong game for USC to prove that they still have this type of game in them. Adds a little intrigue to that Oregon game.
And last thing on that, Zach Ertz, maybe the most well-rounded and best tight end Stanford has, it looks like he's going to be out for that game. So this three tight end mammoth formation that they run is going to need to be tweaked a little. They still have two of the best tight ends in the country, but with Ertz out, that could affect them against Oregon.